The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
But my impression is that among the arrests that are being made now, there are still arrests. You know, the number goes up every couple of days. There's a much higher percentage of felonies among the new arrests, too, because they're finding, you know, the people that assaulted the officers. They've got, you know, the FBI has a list of, I think, 350 people they're still looking for. And the people that I think... In the last 10 days, I've seen 6 new arrests, and I think 4 of them were for assaults against law enforcement, something like that. So it looks like it's a higher percentage of felonies now.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 15th, 2021. Roger Parloff is a senior editor at Lawfare and the author of the recent article, What Do and Will the Criminal Prosecutions of the January 6th Capitol Rioters Tell Us? It is a deep dive on the demographics, the charges, and the adjudications of the Capitol riot cases so far. Roger joined me and a live Lawfare audience on Friday in the virtual Jungle Studio for a Q&A with Lawfare material supporters. We talked about who the Capitol rioters were, why some of them have been allowed to plead out to misdemeanors, what characterizes the misdemeanor pleas, and who is left among the bigger fish. It's the Lawfare Podcast, November 15th, Roger Parloff on the January 6th Capitol Riot prosecutions.
Roger, I want to start with the demographics of the defendant pool. This is a remarkable group of cases, partly because a single federal district court almost never gets 600 of the same related case arising out of the same incident. So what can we say? You've now looked at this body of cases. What can we say about the group of people who are being charged?
Well, and I think I should say that my demographic analysis comes completely from the George Washington University program on extremism. They've done great work on keeping track of all of this stuff. I think we're up to about 659 cases federal. It's over 675 if you include some of the DC Superior Court cases. And of the federal cases, the average age is 39. It's mainly men. It's about 86%. It's about 12% military people, former military, although one active military. The highest represented states in absolute terms are Florida, Texas, and Pennsylvania. Per capita, it's DC, Montana, Pennsylvania, and Kentucky. And they assure me that DC is a real number. It's a little hard. I mean, I know it's the most convenient spot, but I'm surprised to see it so overrepresented. And then basically, there have been about 126, at least 126 guilty pleas so far. So that's about 19%. The guilty pleas so far are very, very heavily weighted toward the lightest cases, least serious cases.
Yeah, so let's talk about the guilty pleas. You start the piece by noting that Chief Judge Beryl Howell seems annoyed by them. A lot of commentators seem annoyed by them. So roughly one out of six cases has pled out. Let's talk about what the cases that have pled out have in common. If you're a January 6th insurrectionist, what do you have to have done or not done in order to have had your case pled out? And what is it likely to mean for you?
Well, we don't know for sure if the government is, if this is a conscious strategy. There's some evidence it is, that they want to really get rid of the misdemeanor cases and focus on the felony cases. And so there's a lot of misdemeanor cases. Class A would be misdemeanor would be the top charge that have been allowed to plead out to a Class B misdemeanor, which is something like parading, demonstrating, protesting in a Capitol building. And that's a maximum of 6 months. And approximately 75% of all guilty pleas so far have been Class B misdemeanors. So that gets some people bent out of shape, because it seems like, why are these people walking? And a lot of them are, in essence, walking. But I think it's probably sensible. These are the nonviolent people. And it's usually first offenses. They're often mitigating circumstances. And it's obviously difficult for the judges and for the prosecutors, really, because you have this simply difficult situation. You have a violent mob, but a lot of the people in it are sort of walk-ons, and they play a role. If you're overwhelming the police, it's the numbers that allow you to do that. And so there is culpability in this event that is historic, that did threaten democracy. And yet what they actually did is not what we would ordinarily punish very severely. So there's a real tension, and it's being resolved, I think, in a sensible way, but maybe the only way. And these are not people that are, they're not pleading down from felonies.
That's an interesting point. You say these are nonviolent, and they're pleading down from misdemeanors to other misdemeanors. How consistently true is that? Is that a uniform rule? Are there exceptions to it?
Well, of all the pleas, and of course, I wrote it, when I wrote it, there were 115 guilty pleas. At that point, I was aware of only two instances where there a felony had ever been charged. And it was usually, when you read it, you thought to yourself, when you read the charging document, why is this one being charged as a felony? Because it looks like all the others. And, it could have been in the charging instrument, not an indictment. So I think it's been very consistent. 85% who've pled have been misdemeanors, and 75% have been Class B misdemeanors. Some of those A misdemeanors came down from a felony, but that's where we are.
Yeah, so the ones who pled down from a felony to a Class A misdemeanor, what do those cases look like?
There weren't that many of them. Often what happened was they were still nonviolent, but they got further into the Capitol. If you went into the Senate chambers, but were nonviolent, or you went into somebody's office, but were nonviolent, that probably earned you a felony charge, but you might have been allowed to plead to a Class A misdemeanor.
All right, let's get inside the head of Merrick Garland and the Justice Department team that is trying to create some degree of harmony in to make sure cases are treated like. Is it fair to infer from this that there has been a policy decision okay, if you were there and trespassing and protesting, but you weren't involved in beating cops, you didn't destroy property, you didn't, you know, dress up with antlers and a cape, and you know, you're not one of the really iconic figures of the thing, and you didn't hurt anybody. We both, because we think it's roughly the right justice outcome, or because we're never going to be able to manage the caseload if we prosecute all these cases to a max, we're not going to insist on a felony plea, and we're not going to, you know, go to the wall to make sure you get as much jail time as possible.
I think that's right. And it would also be futile, I should point out. I mean, some judges are bent out of shape, but they don't really often, when push comes to shove, they don't impose greater sentences than the government is asking for, and often they go under.
Yeah, so let me ask you about that, because we've seen a number of cases now where, you know, judges have sort of huffed and puffed, you know, hey, you guys are, say this is an insurrection, but you're letting this guy, you're not recommending any significant jail time. And then they come in and they come in under the government's sentencing recommendation. How should we understand the behavior of the judges here?
Yeah, that's a very strange thing. This is what Chief Judge Beryl Howell did recently. She spent a long time huffing and puffing and came in under the recommendation. She claimed that she said that she felt that her hands were sort of tied by the light sentences given by other judges. I haven't really found that to be the case. The B misdemeanors aren't governed by sentencing guidelines, so there's more discretion, and they seem to be using discretion. Some people do get small jail time. There's been as much as 6 months, although that was a special case. But usually it might be 90 days or 30 days, but then there's home confinement, and then there's pure probation, and then there's some will give 5 years probation, some will give 2 months probation. And in fairness, you know, it's just like all criminal cases, the facts really are different, and sometimes the criminal history is different. You know, one had recently been released from prison on a attempted murder charge. So, you know, he got a serious penalty. But most are not. And then, you know, sometimes they can be heard on their own. You know, they all recorded, so many of them recorded what they were doing on their phones. And some can be heard, you know, urging others not to vandalize. And everyone gets credit for quickly turning themselves in and at least seeming repentant. Although some of the judges have been a little burned by that. The first defendant to be sentenced by Judge Lamberth seemed repentant, and he gave her probation, and then she went on Fox and did not sound repentant. He's been quite upset about that.
Yeah, I would just say if there's one judge on that court not to screw around with, it's Royce Lamberth, having watched that court for many years. So I'm curious about how Judge Roger Parloff would think about these cases. You said you think the Justice Department's judgment is to get rid of these cases is basically reasonable. I'm curious, if you were a judge sitting on one of these cases or having reviewed a bunch of them, do you look at them and say the sentencing is basically reasonable, that it's basically too lenient, that it's basically too harsh? What's your instinct about the aggregate disposition of these cases?
Aggregate, it seems about right. Every once in a while, there's one I say, what happened there? There's some that are disturbing. And then, you know, it's clear that there are some, you know, some judges have different predispositions. There are, you know, there are reporters that are also steeped in these cases that have been really observing every sentencing Alan Foyer at the Times and Zoe Tillman at BuzzFeed and some of the others. And they've remarked on, it's obvious that Tanya Chutkan is a little tougher. She's gone over the recommendation. Trevor McFadden has gone under the recommendation a number of times, at least a few times. Beryl Howell is sort of down the middle. But, you know, within the parameters of a B misdemeanor, it's all fairly nuanced, you know, which is why there aren't sentencing guidelines to begin with. So it makes sense. The thing I haven't, you know, mentioned, there's a huge challenge to the government that is also pushing these guilty pleas for the nonviolent cases, which is speedy trial rules, not for them per se, but for the serious cases, the people, especially the people detained. There are these speedy trial rules, and the challenge is that the discovery that they need to get to hundreds of defense counsel is enormous. The prosecution needs to turn over. There's probably never been a situation where a crime was so documented as this one was, with an ocean of, you know, news media footage. You have 515 security cameras on the Capitol grounds. They've produced like 4,800 hours of video. You've got 900 body-worn cameras on cops, police, and they've produced something like 1,600 hours of video. So all of this needs to be turned over somehow, terabytes of data. And meanwhile, you've got to do that while you're also prosecuting hundreds of serious felony cases. And I should say, in fairness, there's only been a few felonies sentenced, but they've gotten serious sentences.
Yeah, so hold off on the felonies yet. Let's finish up with the misdemeanors. So just to make sure I'm understanding you on this point, the value from the government's point of view in getting rid of these cases, even at the risk of being somewhat lenient, is that it frees up prosecutorial resources to focus on the onerous problem of the 500 or so felony cases, some of which have significant speedy trial issues, but also significant discovery issues. Is that fair?
That's right. I wouldn't say 500. I would say it's about half of the total are felony cases. But yes. And remember also that, you know, even when this happened, they were backed up because of COVID. And so it's a big office, but it has to do all the conventional DC crimes. And suddenly 650 cases are dumped on them and with speedy trial obligations.
All right, so let's talk about the much smaller number of felony pleas. How many have there been, and what can we say about them at this stage?
I guess it's about 15% of 660, and then only about three have been sentenced so far, but they've gotten 8 months, 14 months, and then this week, 41 months. The 41 months was the first case of a somebody that assaulted a police officer that was sentenced. And that was a guideline sentence, the low end of the guideline, but he was also the first of those people to plead. And again, it's a weird situation where he punched one guy in the face, but then there's no question he had earlier helped rescue two police officers that were in trouble. So it's very difficult sentencing decisions, in fairness. And I think he was a military veteran as well. And no one knows which way that cuts in this case. Does that make it worse, which the prosecution says, or does that make it, you know, is that, as it usually is, something in your favor? And I think Judge Beryl Howell, who is an Army brat herself, as she said, thinks it weighs in their favor.
So the other two who have been sentenced, what is a felony plea that nets you an 8 months or 14 months that's not a violent case is, are these property destruction matters?
One was extremely odd, and there have been two of these. One was a interstate communication of threat. And he came, he came to Washington, and he pretended to be at the Capitol riot and issued a great number of very violent threats against Nancy Pelosi and others. And he also had 18 prior convictions. So it was a pretty unappealing case, but it was a very unusual case. There's one other threat case like that. And the other one, I'm afraid I just can't remember it at the moment. It was lower than the prosecutors were seeking 18 months and they gave 8 months. I can't remember the details on that one. Among the other guilty pleas are some very important things where we know the guidelines are quite stiff. For instance, four oath keepers who were originally charged in a big conspiracy case that still has 17 defendants, they have pled out. They have not been given sentencing dates because they are expected to cooperate. And they are facing very substantial, you know, their guidelines, I can't say offhand here. And there are a number of other, there are other people who have pled to serious crimes of this nature. And there's a couple that are facing more than 5 years based on their sentencing guidelines. I think 10 are facing more than 3 years.
So it's fair to say, based on the pleas already, that the sentences we've seen are the easiest, lowest value sentences, and the ones that are to come are likely to be the stiffer ones. Is that a reasonable generalization?
Absolutely. And also, and this is unscientific, but my impression is that among the new, the arrests that are being made now, there's still arrests, you know, the number goes up every couple of days. There's a much higher percentage of felonies among the new arrests too, because they're finding, you know, the people that assaulted the officers. They've got, you know, the FBI has a list of, I think, 350 people they're still looking for. And the people that, I think in the last 10 days, I've seen six new arrests, and I think four of them were for assaults against law enforcement, something like that. So it looks like it's more, it's a higher percentage of felonies now in the mix.
Okay, so let's talk about the cases that have not yet pled and not yet gone to trial. This is the body of cases. And by dint of the fact that the department is trying to clear its docket of the simple stuff, this is the harder stuff, the more serious offenses. What do these cases look like as a group?
Almost 40% are charged with a crime called obstructing, impeding, you know, corruptly obstructing, influencing, or impeding a congressional proceeding. And that's a little fuzzy. It's not unlike the misdemeanors that have been charged in terms of the elements. But what earns you a felony instead of a misdemeanor is like I said, you go further into the, you go into the Senate, you usually are more ostentatious in your propaganda output on social media, both before and after. So about 40% are those, but about 210 are offenses against law enforcement, and those are very serious. And at least 65 of those involve aggravating circumstances, inflicting bodily injury or having a dangerous weapon. So those are 20-year potential felonies, I mean maximum. And then about 40 are conspiracy cases, and those are pretty interesting cases. Those are the, well, about 17 current oath keepers plus four that have already pled. There's three cases involving Proud Boys. There's one involving some 3%ers. And those are potentially interesting cases. And you can see that the government is, at least with the Oath Keepers, they're going up the ladder, trying to get the higher ups, at least within that organization. Whether it ever goes beyond that organization is highly speculative at this point.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So I'm interested in this intermediate body of cases, the ones that are felonies, but they're felonies that are kind of aggravated examples of the kind of conduct that the misdemeanor cases reflect. So first of all, there's been some consternation among judges that this statute was not meant to reach this sort of activity, that it's actually a, you know, financial crimes statute. How stable do you think the legal landscape is for prosecutors on this? And, you know, to have a couple hundred of these cases riding on this statutory interpretation question seems a little risky, no?
It does to me. I'm concerned about it. And some people are pleading guilty to just that offense. I might be wrong, but I think Jacob Chansley has done that. The QAnon shaman. I think he pled guilty to one felony. I think that's the only one. I might be wrong. But judges Randolph Moss and Amit Mehta have expressed considerable concern about that statute. And I suspect there are a lot of motions to dismiss pending. I suspect that they will uphold it, those judges, but then the real question is, you know, what will the Supreme Court do? And one of the precedents there is, I forget, something like USA versus Yates. It's a case involving, a weird case, also involving a Sarbanes-Oxley law, where somebody threw back a fish as the wildlife inspectors were approaching him. And was that destruction of evidence maybe not what they had in mind? So I'm concerned about it. It does have a definition of proceeding that includes congressional proceedings. So I'm hopeful that that's clear enough. But no, it does. It seems quite risky. And of course, remember, there are two charges that we haven't seen. One is insurrection itself. I can understand that it's not just politically a hot potato, but it's also, it may be hard to prove precisely what was in somebody's mind, that did they want to overthrow the government or was it beyond a reasonable doubt. But the other one is a seditious conspiracy, and aspects of that statute, you know, it's rarely used. The word, the text at least, maybe scholars will disagree with me, but the text at least isn't limited to attempts to overthrow the government. It's also attempts to hinder or delay the execution of a law, which is what this really was for a lot. You know, that is provable with a lot of people that was the whole point, was to stop, to hinder and delay execution of the Electoral Count Act. Of whatever it is, 1887 or whatever.
Right. I mean, it whatever the origins of the statute, it certainly by its terms seems to cover the conduct in question.
Yeah. Ironically, I mentioned Sarbanes-Oxley law is a 20-year felony, and insurrection is a 10-year felony. You know, so it's sort of some irony in that they're going out of their way to avoid these other statutes and grabbing onto one that is itself pretty risky.
All right, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Ben, and pleasure to be here also with you, Roger.
Thank you. Likewise.
So there was relatively little attention given to the level of education of the insurrectionists in the study you mentioned in the article. So what kind of role do you think the level of education or lack thereof had with the people choosing to take part in January 6th? I mean, were they high school, college graduates, or were they even PhDs in the crowd?
Well, I have no data on that. I have some hunches, but I have no data.
So without indulging pure hunches, what are you've spent a lot of time in these case documents. What are your impressions? I mean, I think there's a lot of people have prejudices about who these people were. To what extent do the case documents kind of validate those prejudices, and to what extent is the story more complicated than that?
There is a range, but the cases I've seen, there were some fairly hard scrabble circumstances financially, and universal total belief in the big lie, which at some level, at least for the nonviolent ones, has to be sort of might be a mitigating circumstance. I mean, it wasn't just their president that was telling them to do this. It was practically a whole political party. There was this sense that Biden was synonymous with communism. There were a few that had a sophisticated explanation for why they were there. They sounded almost like Senator Hawley. You know, they were saying, "Well, the state laws were unconstitutional because the state legislators' prerogatives have been impinged." But for some, it was just they were there to protest anti-COVID measures. There were QAnon people. There were mentally ill people. And of course, the educational backgrounds of mentally ill people could be very high. I think that the head of the Oath Keepers, who has not been charged, I think he's a Yale Law graduate.
Indeed.
Yeah, but I think he's gone in the Q direction. I'm really I can't avoid just sort of speculating.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. The floor is yours.
Hey, I wanted to find out if I could a little bit more about interfering with Congress as being a chargeable offense. So it seems like everyone who attended the rally would have been aware that they were interfering with conducting the duty of the Congress. So isn't that something that should be a widely applied charge? And if it is, can you just, again, explain a little bit about the details of that?
So this is, just to be clear, this is the statute that Roger was alluding to earlier, that is just the one that has a large group just above the misdemeanor cases. What is it that distinguishes the misdemeanor cases? Do they not meet one of the elements of that offense, or is it just that they seem like they're not that guilty?
That's the other issue that disturbs Judges Moss and Maeda, is that they don't see a limiting principle as to when to apply the 20-year felony and when to apply the Class A misdemeanor, or in fact, the Class B misdemeanor. Obstructing a congressional proceeding or very clearly violates the B misdemeanor. But when you would charge the felony is a touchy-feely thing. And I think they've been using it in a sensible way, but the judges don't want to say, well, let the prosecutors say, trust us, we'll use it appropriately.
But there's no simple factual hinge which distinguishes the misdemeanor cases from the obstructing Congress felony cases, right? It's not like there's some factor that if it's present, you're in the felony land, and if it's absent, you're in the misdemeanor land.
It would be corruptly. It's corruptly impeding.
As opposed to innocently wandering in and thereby impeding? Like you were there for a protest, but you know, as the wave kind of moved, you moved with it, but they have no state of mind evidence that you were behaving corruptly?
You don't need to prove it with the misdemeanor.
Right. No, that actually seems like a real difference. Like if you've got, you know, Roger Parloff, who was kind of swept along with the crowd and ends up, you know, in the foyer, you can't really prove that he acts corruptly. He doesn't have any social media posts that says, you know, we're going to hang Mike Pence and, you know, stop the steal by, you know, making them open the fake ballots, not the real ballots. But if you've got Roger Parloff who's saying those things, they're actually differently situated, no?
Yeah, I think that if you look at the people being charged with the felony and the people being charged with the misdemeanor, it hits you as making sense. But explaining why, you know, it's not like you can point to, yeah, one used a dangerous weapon. You know, that's what prosecutors like, and that's what judges like to see. I understand the difference. Did they hit somebody? And that's not there. And so it's also a due process issue, not just a congressional intent issue.
All right. We've got a bunch of audience questions from people who do not want to appear on screen. Rachel asks, the January 6th defendant seemed to be getting charged with standard criminal offenses. If sedition and insurrection are crimes, are they in the penal code? Are they considered political actions like impeachable high crimes or abuse of power and don't really exist as criminal offenses? What makes them actions that can be prosecuted and whom? So this is a great question. Roger, take a stab at it.
Well, insurrection is a criminal offense in addition to being, you know, a constitutional offense. And the criminal, you know, it's in the Title 18 of the criminal code.
It's a real crime and it's prosecutable as a crime. And there has clearly been a decision not to prosecute people under it yet.
Right. And, you know, I think a lot of prosecutors, because it gets into what's an insurrection and what's the difference between a riot and an insurrection, and did they intend to do whatever you would define insurrection as. And so all of those are things a prosecutor would rather avoid. That doesn't mean it's a good reason to avoid them. The other thing with insurrection, there's an automatic bar from holding U.S. office. That's in addition, I'm not talking about under the 14th Amendment, it's complex, but if you participate in an insurrection after having taken an oath to uphold the Constitution, then also you can be disqualified from office. But that makes it a very politically explosive thing. Still, the word insurrection has been used by prosecutors, at least in the early days of this, and it's been used by some judges, even in rulings, not you know, in a fairly casual way, just describing what happened, but it's out there. And then I think the more serious question is whether this will eventually be prosecuted as seditious conspiracy, which I think does make sense. And the previous U.S. attorney, acting U.S. attorney in D.C., Mike Sherwin, I think, did say that he thought it would eventually make an appearance. He said that in an unauthorized interview and then was shortly thereafter resigned. So people have been sort of close to the vest since that whole incident. The seditious conspiracy law did show up recently in a search warrant. One of the general counsel of the Oath Keepers said that she got a search warrant to search her phone. And one of the one of nine federal statutes cited was seditious conspiracy. So it's still in the ball game. And yes, that is a real, it's actually the next section of the Title 18 of the U.S. Code after insurrection. Whatever the first is, the next is seditious conspiracy.
And just to be clear, the seditious conspiracy law does have a complicated and interesting history of application, which we have spent a fair bit of time on Lawfare. Jacob Schultz, our managing editor, has written a bunch of pieces historically about the use of the seditious conspiracy law. The most important recent use of it, although it's not that recent anymore, but is the conviction of Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, the so-called blind sheikh, and a bunch of his followers were all convicted of seditious conspiracy in connection with the planned reign of terror in the wake of the first World Trade Center bombing. And so this is a real law that has real application, successful and unsuccessful. And I do think, unlike insurrection, which, as Roger noted earlier, the insurrection statute has a weird quirk, which is that sentencing, the maximum sentence under it is pretty light. And so some of the other statutes, though they don't contain the word insurrection, are actually more powerful prosecutorial instruments.
And I did find, I found the sections. It's 18 U.S.C. 2383 is the insurrection. 18 U.S.C. 2384 is seditious conspiracy.
And if you look at 2384, you will find it remarkably broad and quite on point. That is, you could easily see how some, though not all, of the activity in 1-6 could be covered by it. Richard asks, I have trouble believing that any convictions will have a deterrent effect. Do you have a sense of what, at the end of this process, the Justice Department wants the story of these prosecutions to be? Is it that the rule of law was honored? How concerned is the DOJ that 1-6 is effectively America's beer hall putsch?
Well, I think they are concerned. I think 659 prosecutions speaks for itself. It's the largest federal investigation ever, and they are trying to get everybody involved, which seems to be at more than 2,000 people. And they recognize that general deterrence is important, and putting people through this, and obviously a lot of people didn't expect this to be taken seriously, or they expected to win. I don't know what, or they expected to be pardoned. I'm not sure. But one thing I left out in the beginning and probably should have mentioned, 80%, and this is according to the George Washington University Program on Extremism, more than 80% of these cases relies, at least in part, on evidence from social media, usually their own social media. You know, these even serious people that were battling with the police for hours would take time out and do videos of themselves and, you know, juxtapose arrows saying, this is me. And even those that didn't post filled their phones with incriminating videos, which can be reached through search warrant and have been. So, I think it's been a surprise to a lot of these people that this is a crime. Many are expressing remorse, obviously, but I think some of it is legitimate. They're also expressing anger at Trump for having told them to go down there and then having abandoned them and, you know, not having pardoned them. And that's probably healthy, too.
Auntie, the floor is yours once again.
Thanks. So, have direct substantial links between foreign social media misinformation campaigns and the January 6th rioters been discovered during the criminal prosecution so far?
Yes, there certainly are. I mean, and of course, one of the most important things was Trump on Twitter saying, you know, go on January 6th, it'll be wild. That tweet was incorporated into advertisements, but in any event, it was something that you can see people referring to in texts, in on Facebook posts. My president has said, it'll be wild, I need to go. When he says it'll be wild, he means he wants us to make it wild. There's some powerful stuff there. You know, I can't, in terms of statistics of the 650, 660, I don't know how many, but, and then of course, just the big lie itself. That is universal. That is universal. And that got out there, you know, largely through social media, but also Fox News and other organizations.
So we're going to close with a pair of questions from Diana, who asks, what will it take to establish the truth of the January 6th events? Can we get there from here? I assume she means in the context of these criminal cases. And then separately, she asks, which I think is really a variant of the same question, will the reality of January 6th ever become the agreed upon narrative, the consensus that we all carry?
Well, we have a sort of an active opposition right now to accepting this narrative, which I don't call a narrative, it's the facts. But, you know, we saw Tucker Carlson has a three-part documentary out suggesting that this was a false flag operation, maybe perpetrated by the FBI. And Fox News is helping him propagate that. And very few Republicans are condemning it. Just the usual people, Liz Cheney and Kinzinger and one or two, you know. So that's a good question. Does any of this get through? I don't know. Now, as far as will this, how much clarity will the criminal investigations provide? It's one way of coming at this. Obviously, the congressional investigations are an important and maybe more important one. And then there's also a lot of civil suits, some brought by police officers, some brought by Congress people, and then the voting machine companies. Those suits are shedding light. So there's a lot of different angles converging on the same thing. And we hope that all together, historians at least, will understand what happened. But we don't seem to be moving toward consensus. I don't see that.
On that cheerful note, Roger Parloff, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is Hamza Situ of Goat Rodeo. Hey guys, if you become a material supporter of Lawfare, you could be the next person asking the questions on these podcasts. You should, in any event, do your part to promote the Lawfare Podcast on social media. Leave us a rating or review wherever you found us and buy our merch at thelawfarestore.com. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by Jen Patya Howell. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.